Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Day Out Debate podcast. I'm Tim Hustlebury.
And I'm Chris Kerr.
This week, we discuss Bradley Wiggins, who's turned himself into one of Britain's greatest sporting icons. However, over the last year, we have begun to learn his journey to the top is not quite as clean as it once seemed. We will look over the highs and lows of Wiggins' career, and we look at what's going on right now. So Chris, where did his career all begin?
Well, Bradley Mark Wiggins was born on the 28th of April 1980 in Ghent, Belgium, to an Australian father, Gary Wiggins, and a British mother, Linda. His father lived in Belgium as a professional cyclist, rather unsurprisingly. His father left the family when Wiggins was just two. Wiggins moved with his mother to her parents' house in Villiers Road, Willesden Green, northwest London, then to a church commission flat at Dibden House Estate in neighbouring Maida Vale. He was educated at St Augustine's Junior School and then St Augustine's Church of England High School in Kilburn, where his mother was a secretary. He has a younger half-brother, Ryan, from his mother and her partner, Brendan, who separated when Wiggins was in his late teens. Growing up, football was Wiggins' passion. He was an Arsenal fan, boo hiss, although he would watch rivals Tottenham Hotspur cheer everybody because his friends supported them. Mm-hmm. He discovered cycling when his mother told him to watch the television coverage of the individual pursuit final in the 1992 Olympic Games in Barcelona, which featured Britain Chris Boardman, and who won the event. She explained it was one of the events at which his father had been successful. He watched the rest of the Olympics and fell in love with cycling and the Olympics itself from that point. In 1992, aged just 12, he entered his first race, the West London Challenge 92, on the unopened A312 dual carriageway in Hayes, West London. Later that year, he broke a collarbone in a road accident and he received £1,700 compensation for his injuries. He gave his mother £700 and used the rest to buy his first racing bicycle. At 12, in his autobiography, he recalled, "I told my art teacher I'm going to be an Olympic champion. I'm going to wear the yellow jersey in the Tour." With those dreams in mind, he represented Westminster in the London Youth Games as a teenager, and in 2010 he was inducted into the London Youth Games Hall of Fame. At 16, he won the 1 kilometre time trial at the 1996 Junior National Track Championships in Leicester, and the selectors invited him to train at weekends at the Manchester Velodrome. After leaving school, he enrolled on a BTEC foundation course in business studies, but left due to his cycling commitments. It was very obvious where his passion lay. His breakthrough came in June 1998, winning the 3 kilometre individual pursuit at the Junior Track World Championships in Cuba, aged just 18. The following week, he retained his titles at the Junior National Track Championships in Manchester. He represented England at the Commonwealth Games in Kuala Lumpur, finishing fourth in the individual pursuit, and was a member of the team that won a silver medal in the team pursuit, his first senior medal. In 1999, he began training with the Great Britain Team Pursuit Squad and rode the Pro Tour, now known as the Tour of Britain, his first stage race at that level. In October, he competed in the World Track Cycling Championships in Berlin, coming fifth in the team pursuit, with partner Rob Hales came 10th in the Madison, securing qualification for the 2000 Olympic Games in Sydney. At the Olympics, he won a bronze medal in the team pursuit, beating France, and came fourth in the Madison with Hales. And in October 2000, he took silver in the team pursuit at the Track World Championships in Manchester, losing to Germany in the final by under half a second. And it was after this, in 2001, that he began his professional career and stopped being an amateur.
So to carry on from that, in the 2002 Commonwealth Games, he won team and individual pursuit silver. And then in 2003 World Championships, he won another team pursuit bronze. It was after this point that he really began to mature as a cyclist. And in the 2004 Olympics, he won his first Olympic gold in the individual pursuit, won team pursuit silver, and he got bronze in the Madison. In the 2007 World Championships, he won gold in the individual pursuit and gold in the team pursuit. And in 2008 Beijing Olympics, individual pursuit gold and team pursuit gold. And then obviously 2012, he won time trial gold. And in 2016, he won the team pursuit gold, both in the Olympics. So that's just his track career. What about his road cycling career, Chris?
Well, his road cycling career was very varied. He's had many, many teams in his time. In early 2005, he revealed his desire to compete in road cycling again, having focused on the track for quite some time. And in April, won the 16-kilometre time trial around the town of Briey in northeastern France on the second stage of the Circuit de Lorraine. It was after this that he believed that this may be his best chance of getting greater success on the road, and that this could be a successful path for him, having already achieved so much success on the track. And in 2009, he made his Tour de France breakthrough, having switched his focus after the 2008 Olympics to the road. He moved his family to the city of Girona in northeast Spain, where Garmin Slipstream were based, his team. He started the season in February by helping the team win the opening team trial of the Tour of Qatar, crossing the line first to take the leader's jersey. And in April, he won the time trial on the final stage of the 3 days of Dapan, 20 seconds ahead of Vacansoleil rider Louis Westra in second place. Wiggins arrived at the Tour de France that year having lost 6 kilograms and was nicknamed Twiggo instead of his usual Wiggo. He came third in the time trial on stage one in Monaco, 19 seconds behind Team Saxo Bank's Cancellara and one behind Contador. After various moves throughout the race, Wiggins moved back up to fourth after finishing in second place in the time trial on stage 19, finishing in sixth place 42 seconds down on winner Contador. In October 2012, following the disqualification of Lance Armstrong, who had originally placed third in the general classification, Wiggins was promoted to third place himself overall. This decision retroactively gave him the first podium finish by a British rider in Tour de France history. And in 2010, he moved to Team Sky, which would prove to be a massive move in his career and the start of some of the controversy, which we'll move on to later. Wiggins began 2010 as a team leader for the first time with Sky, and his main target was to win the Tour de France. In February, he was part of the team that won the opening team time trial of the Tour of Qatar again, before taking second place in the team trial on stage 4 of the Vuelta at Andalusia, behind Alex Rasmussen of Team Saxo Bank. In May, Wiggins took his first Grand Tour victory in the wet streets of Amsterdam in the opening time trial of the Giro d'Italia, becoming the second Briton to wear the pink jersey after Cavendish in 2009. Wiggins then went to a training camp in the Alps, testing the mountain stages used for the Tour as he tried to gain fitness ready for the Tour de France. He returned to racing in August of that year after some injury problems, and in September retained his title at the National Time Trial Championships before finishing the season at the Tour of Britain. His season ended at the Giro di Lombardia, where he was forced to abandon following a crash, and it was fair to say Wiggins had had a fair amount of bad luck during this time with crashes and injuries. And over the winter, he trained with the Great Britain squad at the Manchester Velodrome, perhaps looking at track cycling again. But it was, as mentioned already by Tim, in 2012, the Tour de France and Olympic gold, it was something of a landmark year for Wiggins. And in 2012, Wiggins particularly continued to focus on road racing. The individual pursuit was removed from the programme at the Olympics later in the year, and in December 2011, his coach actually was quoted saying, "The chance of him doing the team pursuit are really slim now." He began his 2012 season with third in the Volta Algarve, including victory in the concluding time trial, edging out world champion Martin by less than a second, therefore giving him confidence for the rest of the season. And Wiggins entered the Tour de France as one of the favourites to win it. Wiggins began the Tour with the second place in the prologue before Cancellara of Radio Shack Nissan. He took over the yellow jersey by finishing third on stage 7 and the first mountaintop finish, becoming the fifth British rider to wear the jersey and the first since David Miller in 2000. Wiggins won the time trial on stage 9, and on stage 10 he and his team staved off an attack by Nibali on the descent of the Col de Grand Colombier, leading Nibali to accuse Wiggins of disrespecting him. Wiggins went on to have lots more success in the coming stages. Wiggins won the time trial on stage 19, giving him a lead of 3 minutes and 21 seconds at the start of the final stage. And at that stage, Wiggins helped teammate Cavendish achieve his fourth consecutive victory at the Champs-Élysées and confirmed his own overall victory in the process. Wiggins became the first and is currently the only person in history to win the Paris to Nice and the Tour de Romandie, the Critérium du Dauphin, and the Tour de France in a single season.
Alongside winning Olympic gold in the same year as well. So, yep. First cyclist to win the Tour de France and Olympic gold in the same year.
That's not bad at all, is it?
Yeah, pretty tidy year. Well, that was a pretty comprehensive history of Bradley Wiggins when he started giving us his birthplace and date and the roads and where the towns he lived in. I thought, bloody hell, this is going to be the entire podcast just listening to the history to Bradley Wiggins. But yeah, that's pretty comprehensive. But he also managed to break the hour record attempt, which is essentially when cyclists ride as hard as they can for an hour and see how far they can go. And back in June 2015, he managed to cycle 54.526 kilometres or 33.881 miles in just 1 hour, which is absolutely ridiculous, beating the record hold by another Brit set earlier in the year. And that has not been beaten since. So, yeah, he's pretty well decorated. He's got quite a few medals, as I said. One of the great British icons in a sporting sense. You know, he's up there with Steve Redgrave, Chris Hoy himself, obviously. Yeah, he's just a sporting legend in this country.
Yeah. Just to finish off his background before we start going on to all of the rest of the controversy, obviously he then went on to win his fifth Olympic gold in 2016. Before retiring from it all. So I'm sure he was thinking at that point that maybe he'd be out of the media spotlight for a little bit. But back at his come at him, and on top of those achievements on the track and on the road, he also managed to find time to found a team for road cycling as well. And after much speculation in part of the 2014 road season, in order to better facilitate his return to the track, as part of his preparations for the aforementioned 2016 Olympic Games, he helped support this team with a reported budget of £460,000, and set up what was an all-English team for a little bit, which eventually had a few more successful riders from other countries, but it supplemented the British Riding Academy. So clearly getting the next generation of young English riders was a key thing to him, and in March 2015... Wiggins debuted with the team in the inaugural Tour de Yorkshire, so it was definitely a British affair.
Good bloke.
He's achieved a lot.
He also managed to set up his own fashion brand, I think, alongside Fred Perry.
Yes, that's right.
Niche kind of thing going on, so that's also pretty cool. So he's managed to fit quite a lot into about 15 and a half years, 16 years or so. So yeah, good on him. Anyway, let's move on to the
savoury stuff.
Yes, less savoury stuff, the big elephant in the room. So, Chris, tell us about the infamous Jiffy Bag incident.
Well, the Jiffy Bag incident comes back to a UK anti-doping independent body, which decided to conduct a 14-month investigation into the contents of a Jiffy Bag, which was delivered to Team Sky at the 2011 Critérium du Dauphin for Wiggins use. The package was collected from British Cycling's office in Manchester by the British Cycling women's manager, Simon Cope, on the request of Shane Sutton, then the technical director of British Cycling. And Cope carried the package on a flight to Geneva, after which he drove to meet Richard Freeman, the British Cycling doctor who administered the drug to Wiggins. And Cope denied knowing that what was in the package. In December 2016, Sir David Brailsford, who ran British Cycling and Team Sky in 2011, informed the Digital Culture, Media and Sports Select Committee that the package contained the legal decongestant Fluimisil, if I'm saying that right, which can be bought at chemists in France without a prescription. UK Anti-Doping began its investigation in 2016 following a tip-off that a bag had been delivered to Wiggins containing the banned corticosteroid triamcinolone, which allows riders to lose weight while maintaining power. And UK Anti-Doping's investigation was hindered by the fact that Dr. Richard Freeman, the aforementioned British cycling doctor who administered the drug, was too ill to give evidence to the inquiry. So UK Anti-Doping closed its 14-month investigation into the package after being unable to find evidence that it contained a banned substance. It released a statement which said that its investigation had been hampered by the lack of availability of detailed medical records. Parts of the investigation remain open at this moment in time, as UK Anti-Doping has not yet been able to establish why products containing testosterone were delivered to the National Cycling Centre. And Nigel Huddeston, MP, said it was extraordinary that a select committee was required for this simple fact to emerge, and he questioned the transparency, communication and governance of UK cycling. So some fairly damning stuff to come out of this.
Yeah, If we just quickly go back to trimethoxazolone, yes. It's essentially an anti-inflammatory drug, basically, used for treating things like eczema, lupus, skin conditions, and what Wiggins claimed to use it for, which was allergies. And it can be injected, inhaled, or rubbed on a particular area as a cream. But outside of the obvious medical benefits, it's thought that the drug can help cyclists lose body mass, so weight, essentially, without losing their power. And obviously having a lower body mass while you're on a bike means that, and retaining the power means that you'll be able to go quicker, obviously, because more power moving less weight equals quicker speed, essentially.
So that would be a huge advantage.
Obviously, if everyone was taking it, fine. But, you know, it's a banned substance and they've got a TUE for it, so...
Yeah, so Tim, what is a TUE, just for those that don't know what it is?
So a TUE, a therapeutic use exemption, is essentially where an athlete can demonstrate that they need a particular substance that's on the banned substance list for a medical purpose. So in this instance, the corticosteroid was used to treat Bradley Wiggins' allergies. That might have been hay fever, I think, was
yes,
the claim.
Yes, that was what was cited, yeah.
So a doctor can apply for it, and it has to be ratified by another doctor, I think, and then it's sent off to the anti-doping people, who either accept or reject it. But I think a lot of the time, if you apply for a TUE, you'll probably get it.
Yeah.
I don't think we've quite gone into the findings from the DCMS.
No, not report, yet.
But long story short, they've really gone to right to the edge of the ethical sort of boundaries of what's acceptable and what's not with this whole incident. And yeah, it's quite interesting that it's taken quite so long to get out. Considering it happened over 5 years ago, and it was really right at the start of, not at the start of Wiggins' success necessarily, but right before he was thrust into the limelight. Obviously, 2012 was a big
before,
year.
Before his biggest successes, maybe.
Yeah.
Just to quote what they actually said on that, they said, so Bradley Wiggins and Team Sky crossed an ethical line by using drugs allowed under anti-doping rules to enhance performance instead of just for medical need. It's fairly damning, and it's as damning as you can be without saying that you actually broke the rules.
But let's read between the lines here. They're saying you broke the rules, but you did it in such a way that we can't punish you for it because you've actually done all the right steps to get there.
Yeah. So Team Sky said it strongly refutes the report's serious claim that medication has been used by the team to enhance performance. And Wiggins has since said in a statement, "I find it so sad that accusations can be made where people can be accused of things they have never done, which are then regarded as facts. I strongly refute the claim that any drug was used without medical need." They're fighting it all the way, as you probably would expect.
Yeah, it's not surprising. This sort of feels like Lance Armstrong.
It does, doesn't
the
it?
The stuff that he was saying when he was being accused of being a drug cheat, even in the face of sort of overwhelming evidence to the contrary, he was very much, I don't do this, I'm not a drug cheat, I've been tested all these sort of times, I've never been found to have failed a test once, I'm not a drug cheat, I'm not a drug cheat, blah, blah, blah. whilst I'm not saying that, you know, we can 100% label Wiggins as a drugs cheat and Team Sky of doing some dodgy manoeuvres, I think that the evidence is overwhelmingly towards that end.
Yeah.
Something that grates with me a bit is the relationship between Team Sky and Team GB, because there's a lot of crossover between a lot of the staff.
Yeah.
So where does this become an Olympic problem or a Team GB problem? Where is it a Sky problem? It feels very much to me like DCMS have gone, oh, this is Team Sky issue. Whereas in reality, it's probably a Team GB issue as well, because it's all the same people. So then where does this extend to, and who does it extend to? Is it isolated with Bradley Wiggins, or is this something that Team Sky, Team GB, whatever?
Yeah.
I thought, actually, let's start applying for these TUEs and see what sticks. And if we can get something beneficial for athlete X and doing sport Y, then, you know, why not do it?
Just to pick up on that, also in the same report, the long-awaited Combating Doping in Sport report, it also states that Lord Coe, the president of the Athletics World Governing Body, the IAAF, gave misleading answers and evidence about his knowledge of doping allegations in Russian athletics before they were made in the German television documentary in 2014. So it wasn't, this report wasn't just looking into Bradley Wiggins on his own. And the DCMS committee was also shocked that British four-time Olympic champion athlete Simone Farah received an injection of the legal supplement L-carnitine before the 2014 London Marathon that was not recorded on Farah's medical records. So these concerns are going wider than just Wiggins and cycling, sadly.
This brings it on to quite another point regarding the medical staff actually involved in all of these cases. I mean, what was the name of the chap? Yeah, so the British cycling doctor Richard Freeman not reporting giving dosages of medicines to athletes, you know, like we just said with the Mo Farah. I mean, these are meant to be the doctors at the top of their game, the best in the country at whatever they're specifically doing. And they're that bad that they're not recording stuff properly is what they're claiming. Because if it's not doing something dodgy, then they're terrible doctors, aren't they? Yeah. Because they're not recording it properly. So one way or the other, they're not doing their job. Yeah, this is way too fishy for me. And it's sad because, to be honest, the lack of mention of Chris Froome in this has been not alarming, but it's been noticeable because obviously fairly recently we've had Chris Froome allegations with his asthma and that sort of stuff and the stuff he was taking. So my doubts are running wild with British cycling at the moment, with Team Sky at the moment, and how much of this success that we've had is true success, how much is altered success, if you like.
It does make you worry about any sort of thing like that. As you say, you'll be concerned just by his absence of Chris Froome and these allegations of, it's weird that it's taken this long actually for it to come out, because there's been allegations of this kind of stuff for a while. There was a leaking of Wiggins' personal medical history by a group of hackers called the Fancy Bears in September 2016, which raised concerns then about Wiggins' use of TUEs, as you say. So I think it is slightly concerning that maybe it's taken these investigations this long to find it.
I think there is a temptation to make sure that they're not jumping the gun with these sort of things, and they can only use the evidence that they have. I don't think that they'll be using the Fancy Bears stuff, personally. I'm not sure that's 100% legitimate.
You can't trust the hackers' stuff, can you really?
Yeah. But then at the same point, it can indicate the athletes who may or may not have been cheating, so at least it gives you a little direction in which to look, even if you're not using the data itself. Yeah, it's kind of scary, to be perfectly honest with you. I'm not a fan of what's going on, and I'm pretty sure most people around the country aren't. And regardless of what happens in this sort of case, I think it's sort of coming to an end. That's the end of the report. They're not going to do anything to Froome. I mean, Froome. They're not going to do anything to Wiggins because there's nothing they can do. They took the required steps to get that TUE. They got it, and they used the drugs, and it's up to you to decide whether or not it gained him an unfair advantage. But I don't think it's much of a coincidence that this jiffy bag was 2011 and all of his success happened afterwards.
Yeah.
Whilst the stick used by a lot of people is, oh, that lots of people in cycling dope, why not me?
Well, yeah,
you know,
that's not an excuse, is it?
It's not an excuse.
Because he did it, it's not an excuse for anything.
Well, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy then, isn't it? If you just assume everyone's going to dope and you do yourself, when does it stop? It'll just be a constantly dope sport. And I feel like we're just doing some cycling bashing now, but it's very wrong. It's just not nice to hear
That's the whole other point about it, surely, that it's been so hush-hush. If they thought they were doing something legitimate, surely they'd have done it out in the open because they knew they could get away with using TUEs properly. But they know that this is shady stuff that they're doing. So therefore, there is this kind of cover up over it, and it's as we've mentioned in so many other podcasts, it's about what shade of grey we think it is. Is it a ridiculously dark shade of grey where they have pushed everything way too far and they should get some sort of punishment? But as you say, that's difficult. That is difficult to do because technically they haven't broken any rules. And as you also mentioned, it's difficult to know where it will go from him because Wiggins is already retired. So what can you do to him? You can't give him a cycling ban. That's not gonna affect him.
And there's not enough there to strip him of titles and that sort of thing because the evidence clearly isn't there. They still don't really know what happened with the jiffy bag.
Exactly.
I think that the report you gave is sort of the best guess as to what happened, and you know, yeah, there were certain things that were well known about where it was carried and who was taking it where, but in terms of actually knowing what was in the bag and when it was taken and why it was taken is a complete mystery, and you can only infer from these things. But the fact that it was in competition is dodgy at best.
Yeah.
And I feel like it would be sort of very hypocritical of us to sit here and go slamming Russia for all their doping and their mishandling of urine.
Yeah.
Whilst ignoring it on the British end. There's always a sort of siege mentality taken, I think, when you're supporting a certain group of people, a certain team. So I would fight you to the death if you said something bad about Tottenham. I'd fight you to the death if you said anything about Great Britain if you weren't a supporter of either of those teams.
Yeah.
But I think when it's plain as day that something really fishy has gone on, we're not going to sit there and rebuff the comments and just ignore them.
Yeah.
I think it's time to get some refreshing honesty and just say, yes, we took it.
Yeah, to use that Russian comparison, they've just used a different way of kind of cheating the system or getting an advantage, and that's got them in hot water, obviously, and that is actually illegal. But we've gone down a different path to get an advantage, and it's turned out that we almost can get away with it, but it's definitely given the riders an unfair advantage, I'd say.
I think what will happen as a result of this will be tighter restrictions on TUEs. Paula Radcliffe, Paul Scholes both played with asthma throughout their careers. Yeah. Did they use these inhalers? Probably. Mm. This is quite a while ago now, but I'm not accusing either of those players or either of those sports people of anything, but you know, asthma is a condition that's quite common around the country and around the world. You can get athletes who do excellently well despite of it, have hay fever, bit of sniffly nose. You can certainly ride a bike despite that, even with streaming nose all over your face. And I can't think that Bradley Wiggins was actually having a streaming nose while he was competing. I think it's a very suitable veil for something very shady.
Yeah.
So yeah, TUEs for me, they've got to go. That, yeah. I just don't see the benefit of them. The only thing it actually does is make it more confusing for the casual fan. It only makes it more confusing for the governing bodies. If there's just a total blanket of you can't use any
black
of these.
Or white. Yeah, you either take them or you don't.
Yeah, you either take them or you don't. If you do, you can't compete.
Yeah.
Simple as that.
That does make life a hell of a lot more simple. And as we mentioned in our previous podcast about the Paralympics and all the classifications and all that kind of stuff, it just makes life incredibly complicated. It's not quite as complicated as that, but does it not help the situation having to deal with all of that stuff on top, because it must take the administration services so much time to actually go through all of these records to actually find out if anything's been done in a misleading way like this has.
But then again, what's the solution to this? Because if they're not getting TUEs, then they'll just be taking drugs surreptitiously, like they are undetectable drugs. And like I said the last time, fighting the war on doping is a constantly losing battle, because you're coming up with new substances to try and help the athletes develop, you know, try and get more power for less weight, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So as I say, it's a losing battle. So do we eventually get to the stage where the athletes are basically kept in a big white building with a few treadmills and bikes in there and people constantly
monitored
watching them
all day and night? Yeah,
exactly. Or do you do that for the sort of 3 or 4 months building up to an Olympic event or Olympic competition or a world competition that the athletes are competing in? Because that's what is required to make sure that drugs aren't a part of the sport.
Yeah. Well, also, the thing it brings up for me, and that we mentioned in our doping podcast, was that it could be any of your sporting heroes right now could be doping and you just don't know about it. Because this, I'm no doubt, there are loads of kids. Well, you can see it out on the roads every single day in England, the amount of people that now go out and cycle because of people like Bradley Wiggins. And it's going to affect them, because he was the poster boy, wasn't he, for cycling, along with Chris Hoy and all the other amazing people that we've had. But he was definitely up there with his 5 gold medals and his Tour de France wins, and his reputation is in tatters.
Yeah, left that silence for drama. I don't really know what more to say on this. I think that it's pretty clear that something very shady has gone on, and that is the end of it as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, sadly, I don't think we will ever get to the bottom of what was in that package.
That is the bottom. I think they found what they're always going to find, and do you accept that Bradley Wiggins used help to get his gold medals? Does it affect us enjoying that moment any more or less? No, because it's already happened. It's like what I said in the last podcast with the Ben Johnson incident. You know, Ben Johnson was caught 3 days later and that joy immediately turned to sourness. But yeah, we've already had all those brilliant moments celebrating Wiggo's gold several times over, and, you know, that those have all happened. That memory stays, but now it's just tainted with the knowledge. It's not completely destroyed by the knowledge.
Yeah, it's just affected his long-term legacy, hasn't it? Yeah,
and it's essentially what's happened is one fishy thing has happened, and it's tarnished his entire career because of it. Because now you can't trust any result.
Him at all.
You can't trust. Do you take the results at face value, or do you believe that perhaps they were enhanced? Whilst again, the stick of everyone does it. It will be used again, but again, it's not an argument. You are the best clean, or you're not the best at all, in my opinion. This is making me angry.
Well, I think it's fairly ironic that we started with all the background on his career, and I mentioned Lance Armstrong getting disqualified from the Tour, and that gave him his first podium in the Tour de France, and then it's almost come full circle, sadly.
I'm not going to sit here and constantly bash him, because you know, this is not like he's just personally gone and got that dose of
there's others involved.
It's, you know, it's not the thing you do by yourself, and I think that in sport the athlete is often not the person to instigate the doping itself. Maybe a coach will just give somebody a bit of cream, say rub that on you, and then you all of a sudden they've rubbed some banned substance into their legs without knowing, and they've got a performance enhancement as a result of it. They didn't even know. It's blind ignorance. I think that's what Justin Gatlin has claimed a couple of times. Whether or not it's true, I don't know. It would be unfair of us to just sit here and say Wiggo is the worst sportsman in world history, because he's not. He's just done tainted. Something with a group of people that's tainted his career, and something that should not have happened. But I don't really know what to think of it right now. It's all just a bit raw, personally. Yeah. I think if you sit back and think, okay, he's done all these achievements. He was clearly one of the best anyway, judging by his previous performances just throughout. But when did this all start? That's the next question you ask. And then you're like, oh my God, did he do this at 19?
Yeah.
Was it really from that early? Did he do it from 14?
Yeah.
When he had his coaching back then, you know, where does this all really begin?
I guess that's for the people listening to it, for them to make their own minds up. They can decide whether they want to trust his early career results, or whether they do think that he was so competitive that he felt he needed an advantage right from the start of his career.
Well, this is an argument used for Usain Bolt being clean. You know, he was always going to be a world beater because he was brilliant as a youngster. I mean, he was, but he wasn't smashing it by the margins that he ended up smashing it in Beijing and Berlin a year later.
Yeah.
He just destroyed the field at a canter, quite literally. And I know he's sort of performance declined as he progressed in his career through injury and that sort of thing. Or did he think, okay, I've won what I needed to win, I've broken the world records I needed to get, I know I'm a top athlete anyway, but now I can stop doing this drug or whatever and just taper off, and no one will ever find out because my samples are clean from X and Y. I know they're clean from this date, but the only dates that potentially could have anything in them would be 08 and 09, and by the time that no, anyone comes back with a means of testing them in such a way that I'm never going to be caught, I could be long retired or dead. I'm not for any second suggesting that Bolt is a cheat. I'm just hypothesizing as to thoughts that might go out through athletes' minds.
Well, that would be even more shocking than this. Obviously, Bolt's pretty much the poster boy of non-doping, clean sport, with all of the guys that have cheated alongside him in the 100 meters field. But in the same way, Bradley Wiggins, in my eyes, in my little bit of experience of cycling, he was kind of the clean cyclist that I knew, because there were so many other tainted cyclists out there. I mean, there's always a sneaking suspicion, isn't there, that when, as you say, British cycling start doing so well out of nowhere, that it might be for some other reason. But you don't really want to believe in that. And I believed in Wiggins being a clean cyclist trying to do it for the right reasons. So the poster boy of British cycling's suffered a bad fate, and I really hope that Usain Bolt doesn't have the same.
I will throw in a caveat that British Cycling, yes, they did do it out of nowhere, but it wasn't really out of nowhere. They suddenly got loads of Olympic funding and were like, here you go, let's win some medals. It was specifically targeted by UK Sport or Sport England, whoever deals with the lottery funding for the Olympics. And they
felt that they could win medals with the talent that they had.
Cycling was not so much with the talent that they had, it's just there was a big area for medals to be gained in cycling because not many countries were truly focusing on it. I think that's why you've seen the Australians and the British suddenly do really well in track cycling because there was this big wide open gap. They both identified it at the same time and they both went pretty hard at developing technologies and developing athletes to win gold medals, not easily, but more easily than, say, in track and field and athletics, where the market, if you like, is pretty saturated. But that's not to say that did they use that money to develop drugs which help athletes and can't be detected. it's just another question, and all this does is raise more and more questions, which just lead you down trails which make you ask more and more questions. Eventually you get to the end, you're just like, what's the point of watching these sports anymore? Because at the back of my mind throughout all the times when I watch cycling from now on, am I going to have it, you know, are these guys doping, or will I just forget about it and enjoy it for the sport's sake? And then you have the discussion, well, okay, if I'm just enjoying sport for sport's sake, then why does it matter if they're cheating or not? I enjoy the thrill of it at the time, and if it finds out they're cheating, it doesn't take that away from me in the future.
Yeah.
I've already had those brilliant moments.
I think I've got a short-term memory on that. I never actually, while I'm watching, I never think, oh, he could be doping. I'm always thinking the best of people in that situation. But yeah, as you say, that doesn't deflect from your viewing of the event at the time. It's only afterwards that you look back at it and think, well, that's sad that memory is now tainted with that as well.
I do agree with you in terms of not actually thinking about it while you compete, which is why particularly the Russia incident sits so badly with me, because I think that it's just been made so obvious that Russia did something wrong by the fact that you have Olympic athletes from Russia competing in various world championships and Olympic games, and that's sort of a big sort of sticker on those athletes, even though they're the clean ones.
Yeah.
Allegedly, they're the clean ones. So it's a sticker unfairly tarnished upon them.
You're right.
Because of decisions by other people. And essentially what this whole cycling thing has done is popped a sticker on everyone involved with Team GB, Team Sky, from not only cycling, but right through the sports. You've mentioned Mo Farah. Is there now an Olympic athletes from GB sticker on all these athletes? Because I know people who have been right to the top of the game in sport, and they're most likely clean, but I can't 100% guarantee it. And as for sure now, I lose words, but you know, this is something that really annoys me. But there's no fix to it. It's an unfixable situation. It's just that there's never going to be a winner unless all athletes suddenly get their own moral high grounds together. And every single athlete does this at a collective moment, just says, right, we're not doping anymore, and just decides to remove it from the game, but it's just not going to happen.
Or we go the opposite way, as we mentioned in our doping podcast, where we have the unclean Olympics and see how well we can do there.
Yeah, exactly. Or I can just set up the Tim pre-Olympics labs, like I said, and just chuck all athletes into there, make it sort of the size of a small county.
Yeah.
Have the Jamaicans at one end, you know, British at the other, the US somewhere in the middle, having a little, like the big bits with the, I'm not going to say what I'm going to say. I was going to say golden showers, but it's not a good point.
With an Olympic village pre-Olympics for them all to stay in to make sure they're all clean.
God, that's a depressing solution. We should do a really fun podcast soon, Chris.
We should.
The next one will have to be a fun one. All right, guys, that's it for the Dugout Debate podcast this week. Thank you very much for listening. We'll pop our extra reading up on our website, www.dugoutdebatepodcast.com. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter and Facebook and other social media at dugout_debate. Thanks, guys, for listening.
Thank you very much, Tim, and thanks, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye.